This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer. The news on the radio, voices that float into your house or car delivering information, often the first you've heard about a particular story, we take it for granted. But now we're going to go back to a time when news on the radio was new, to listen to a voice that helped to define it, the voice of Robert Trout.
This is Robert Trout at our election headquarters in the newsroom in New York. The results of the 1932 election now appear to be certain. The ticket of Roosevelt and Garner has won a clear-cut majority over the Republican ticket of Hoover and Curtis.
The voice of Robert Trout virtually blanketed the 20th century. He started in radio in 1931, moved into television in the 50s. Across seven decades, he broadcast two coronations, four wars, 16 inaugurations, 26 elections, and 33 political conventions. His composure and authority in a crisis were unique and would become the measure of every modern news anchor person to follow. Those of us who've been cast from his mold cannot really say that we have done it any better than he did more than half a century ago. It was a career all the more remarkable because it began before there was such a thing as serious broadcast news. It all started just a few miles from where I'm speaking now, at radio station WJSV in what was then Mount Vernon Hills, Virginia. It's now part of Alexandria.
I wanted to see what a radio station looked like. They were still rather new back in 1931. There were no real newsmen, actually. Nobody was allowed to specialize in news. I was always most interested in it, especially as we were so near Washington. And in those days, I was broadcasting parades. There was the George Washington Bicentennial. John Philip Sousa led the band for the last time in the Capitol Plaza. But those were the days when everybody was so eager to experiment. Every time something new was done, we thought it was a great advance and would go down in the history books, you know, whether it was really an advance or not.
Washington was still a sleepy southern town in 1932. Farmers still plowed within sight of the Capitol. Today's State Department was a slum area. The Pentagon was a pasture. And the WJSV transmitter stood in an open field along the Potomac, on what is now the main runway of Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport. That began to change in November 1932, when Trout reported the election of Franklin Roosevelt. The following March, he broadcast the inauguration. A few days later, Robert Trout added a new phrase to the history of the American presidency, the fireside chat.
8 days after his inauguration, the banks were closed. Nobody knew exactly what was going to happen. So on the eighth day after Roosevelt's inauguration, it was a Sunday night, he was going to go on the air and talk to the people and explain this whole business. He sent word over to the radio station that he was not going to make a formal address. It was going to be a rather informal thing, and I was assigned to help prepare a couple of introductions. One of them was a formal introduction to be read before the president started, and the other one was a very informal one, and it used the words fireside chat. We sent them both over to the White House, and later President Roosevelt's secretary, Marvin McIntyre, called up and said the president really likes the informal one. That's the one he wants. Use the one about fireside chat.
Over the next 5 years, Robert Trout would broadcast another 10 fireside chats to the nation. When the president would roll out across the country on the presidential special to dedicate the dams and bridges built with New Deal money, Trout would travel with him, always in the same Pullman car and always with the same porter. In 1935, Bob Trout moved from Washington to New York, where he would become the voice of a nascent CBS News.
In the beginning, news at CBS was sustained more by sheer pride than by money. It was a trade-off in which we consoled ourselves that the privilege of inventing our own rules was more important than becoming wealthy.
If we take news gathering for granted today, it's only because once upon a time, in the midst of a looming catastrophe, few men had the skill and the imagination to do it first. One of them was Robert Trout. In one of a series of remarkable reminiscences on All Things Considered, he took us back 60 years to the excitement and uncertainty of global broadcast news at the moment of its creation. It was the Anschluss, March 13th. 1938.
We had the technology. What we needed was an occasion. On this night, we knew we had it. The last hours of peace seemed to be ticking away in Europe. German troops were pouring into Austria, and Hitler was bolting toward Vienna to claim his prize.
To bring you the picture of Europe tonight, Columbia now presents a special broadcast, which will include pickups direct from London, from Paris, and such other European capitals as, at this late hour abroad, have communication channels available. This is Bob Trout speaking to you from New York, opening Columbia's shortwave transatlantic program to cover the key cities of Europe.
But before, as I spoke those words, I crossed my fingers. No one on this earth had ever done a live news broadcast from five world capitals in one program. The outcome seemed as uncertain as the crisis it intended to report. On that night, CBS News hardly existed. We had no newsroom, no studio, and no correspondents. We had Edward R. Murrow and William L. Shirer in Europe, but they were not yet the journalistic eminences they would soon become. CBS confined their duties to setting up broadcasts of lectures and concerts. If I told you how often I heard Ed's voice come into New York Central Control introducing a choir or a swing band, you probably wouldn't believe me. But in the manner of other suspicious allegations these days, I have the tapes.
And so we say goodnight to Stefan Grappoli and Jango Reinhardt and their quintet of the Hot Club of France. They have been playing for you from the Bricktop Cabaret in Montmartre, Paris. This is Ed Murrow speaking and saying, swing it, America.
When there was news in Europe, CBS, in its wisdom, told Murrow and Shirer to schedule a broadcast, then hire a newspaper man to do it. But on this weekend, the Austrian crisis had burst so swiftly, there was no time. In a special report the night before, Shirer became the first CBS employee to go on the air with an eyewitness account of a European story. The result was mildly electric. The next morning, I sat discussing it with my boss, Paul White, a man whose smart news judgment was exceeded only by his fierce instinct for competition. He wondered why we couldn't wrap up all these reports into one program. The fact that no one ever had was a poor excuse to Paul. Within an hour, he telephoned Murrow and Shirer in Europe. He told them to be ready with live reports from London, Paris, Berlin, and Vienna by 1 a.m. European time. They had 8 hours. At 8 p.m., I sat at a microphone set up in the public affairs office, lifted a headphone to my ear, and broke into the regular CBS schedule. The program of St. Louis Blues, originally scheduled for this time, has been canceled.
Tonight, the world trembles, torn by conflicting forces. Throughout this day, event has crowded upon event in tumultuous Austria. As German troops swarm across frontiers in their first offensive since 1914, momentous decisions are being reached in the capitals outside Germany.
We were now ready to begin our radio tour of Europe. First, I said, we take you now to London.
To London, England. William L. Shirer, Columbia's Central.
We take you now to Paris, France.
Sir Edgar Maurer, Chicago Daily News, European. And so now to the city of Berlin, we now switch to hear the opinions of Pierre J. Huss.
In the heat of covering a revolution in Europe, we somehow missed the sense that we were making one in journalism. In 1938, a live voice from Berlin or London penetrated our isolation and imagination in a way that few today can know.
Reporters' reputations rise on the importance of the stories they cover, which is why the greatest reputations are made on stories that alter the course of people's lives. No story in history changed more lives in less time than the launching of the Second World War.
On August 23, 1939, Hitler made his peace with Stalin, set the date for the invasion of Poland, and went to bed content with his day's work. The next morning, the countdown to World War II was ticking. Our new studio at CBS still smelled of fresh paint.
That is the news of Europe at the moment, but the Columbia Network is remaining on all night, open all night, to bring you the news of Europe as it occurs.
And when Hitler kept the lights burning in Europe, our news director, Paul White, kept them burning at CBS round the clock. Recordings were forbidden in those days, so to keep the network on the air between 1 and 5 a.m. for updates and bulletins, a parade of live dance bands played through the night, mostly from hotels and ballrooms still open on the West Coast. When the last hotel closed, there would be organ music. While the music played, I slept.
Good evening, everyone. This is Bob Trout, bringing you the news of Europe. And now the details are beginning to pour in on the reply that Chancellor Adolf Hitler sent to Premier Edouard Daladier of France for arbitration in the dispute with Poland.
At 2:38 in the afternoon, I called in my colleague, William L. Shirer.
To hear the chief of Colombia's Continental Staff, William L. Shirer, we take you now to Berlin.
Hello, America. Hello, CBS. This is Berlin. The sands are running fast. Tonight, we should have a decision whether it's to be peace or war. But the tension has become so terrific that it does not seem possible to anyone that it can long continue.
Minute by minute, it all slipped away as the bulletins poured in.
Minute by minute, the swiftly moving events give a darker picture of the scene abroad on this fateful day of September 1st. As announced by Chancellor Hitler to the Reichstag some 3.5 hours ago, a speech carried on this network, Germany's army has invaded Poland all along the German-Polish frontier. But in France, where a general mobilization is bringing 6 million men into the field, a request has been received from Poland to come to her aid. Poland has now officially asked Britain's aid. In Warsaw, 10 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, Polish ambassadors say that Poland has called upon Britain and France to help her on the grounds of German aggression. 10:45 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, in New York, the stock market turned weak today on the European hostilities. Losses ran to more than $5 a share by 10:30 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time.
It was 11:15 Sunday morning in Britain, 6:15 in New York, when I called in London and Neville Chamberlain, who had to tell his people that Hitler had ignored his ultimatum.
I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war.
8:55 Eastern Daylight Time. Columbia and its affiliated stations bring you Bob Trout and the news.
London has been raided 4 times so far, but today's air raid reports sound pretty much like the air raid descriptions every day. A lot of noise, some casualties, some damage, and determined resistance by the British.
America may still have been neutral, but CBS was not. There were many Anglophiles at 485 Madison Avenue, none more passionate than I. Late in August, my boss, Paul White, decided to set up a broadcast of pickups from London at midnight. When a BBC announcer cued Ed Murrow, none of us at CBS had any idea we were about to catch the first sirens of the Battle of Britain.
And now we take you into the streets of blacked-out London, and so to Trafalgar Square. Waiting there is Edward Murrow, known to you as Columbia's European director. Come in, Ed Murrow.
Suddenly, that evil shrill whistled into 30 million American horns.
This is Trafalgar Square. The noise that you hear at the moment is the sound of the air raid siren. I'm standing here just on the steps of St. Martin's in the Fields.
For the next 2 weeks, 1,000 German planes a day hit English military targets. Then, on September 11th, London suddenly struck back with a jolting barrage of anti-aircraft.
The British are defending the city with the fiercest anti-aircraft fire ever heard in London. The clear night sky is filled with bursting shells, and the shrapnel from the defending British guns is falling on London streets like hail, according to the latest reports.
In the fall of 1941, Ed Murrow returned to America, and Bob Trout sailed to England to replace him. He would remain in London through the summer of 1943. He was there for the invasion of North Africa and the first strategic bombing of Germany by the 8th Air Force. And he was there on that Sunday in December that changed the world forever.
In those days, CBS was the only network to have a regularly scheduled newscast on the air every Sunday afternoon at 2:30, just before the Philharmonic at 3. That afternoon, by an amazing conjunction of timing, World News Today went on the air within seconds of the first United Press flash from Pearl Harbor.
For a direct report on British reaction to the latest moves in the Near East and the Far East, Bob Trout is standing by in the British capital. Go ahead, London.
The BBC would not broadcast the story until the 9 p.m. news. For the next 20 minutes, not even Winston Churchill himself would know what I knew at that moment. CBS in London heard the first news of the attacks on Hawaii and the Philippines
from John Charles Daly in New York just a few moments ago. The report had not arrived in London before this Columbia program began. It is, of course, too early to give you any reaction, but as you know, the British government made plain what would happen if America became involved in war with Japan some days ago.
33 minutes after it began, John Daly ended the most extraordinary newscast of his career.
Columbia will bring you important news bulletins during the broadcast of the New York Philharmonic Society, which follows this program, and will also
now,
bring
if
you
you're asking at this point why, in the midst of the greatest military crisis of the century, news would yield to the New York Philharmonic, you've asked a good question. The truth is, modern broadcast journalism might have been born on that afternoon, but it was not. Inconceivable as it may seem now, hardly a single network program was canceled that day or night for news.
Bob Trout was in London for the first attempt at a cross-channel attack on German-held France.
Britain is getting the details of the Allied raid on the French coast bit by bit. I've been traveling in Britain, Scotland, the north of England, Northern Ireland, and in crowded railway carriages, the word goes round. That's how I heard about it, in a railroad car blue with tobacco smoke and buzzing with exciting conversation. There were no wild rumors about a second front. That's the way it seemed to a traveler in wartime Britain, where newspapers are scarce.
When the second front finally did come on June 6, 1944, millions heard the news first from Robert Trout, who broadcast continuously during the critical early hours. To many communications historians, the modern news anchor function as we know it now reached a kind of critical mass that morning.
We interrupt our program to bring you a special broadcast.
CBS World News, Bob Trout speaking. And again, we bring you the available reports on what the Berlin radio calls the invasion.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, for a special announcement from the Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Forces from London, from Colonel R. Ernest Dupuy. Go ahead, London.
Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
This means invasion. Ladies and gentlemen, here we are back at Columbia's news headquarters.
As people read the papers that day, it somehow seemed clearer. There it was in a 6-inch deep headline you could clip out and pass on to your grandchildren. The press had time to prioritize and process events. But on radio, we blurted out everything the moment we knew it. Our D-Day was a churning, shapeless mosaic for the ear, in constant motion. Facts were scarce, speculation was provisional, conclusions were impossible. We knew nothing about the beach code names, and graphic details of Omaha were beyond our reach. But it didn't matter, because for the first time, radio in its messiness had caught the uncertainties and broken rhythms of a colossal battle in progress. In the dead of that night, radio connected America to one of history's rare epiphanies, in which the stakes were as real as the end was unknown.
In the months ahead, those doubts would fade as Germany was slowly crushed in a massive vice of converging armies. Then in January, Robert Trout was back in Washington broadcasting Roosevelt's fourth inauguration.
This is the White House in Washington. Here today, at the President's home, Franklin Delano Roosevelt begins his fourth term of office. This is Bob Trout speaking from the south side of the building where this wartime inauguration is to be held before several thousand invited.
The new Vice President, Harry Truman, is now about to take
You over. Solemnly swear that you will support...
But few of us want to face the evidence of our eyes and concede that Roosevelt may soon be a casualty of the war.
I do.
This is Columbia's news headquarters in New York once again, and this is Bob Trout speaking. You've probably heard the news. I've been telling it to you for 15 minutes before. You've heard the news that the president is dead. We are slowly getting details, and as they come in, I shall give them to you.
Less than a month later, Germany surrendered, then Japan. For days, Trout was on standby to make the great announcement. It came August 14th, 1945.
The Japanese have accepted our terms fully. That is the word we have just received from the White House in Washington, and I didn't expect to hear a celebration here in our newsroom in New York, but you can hear one going on behind me. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War. It is not, of course, the official VJ Day, but the United Nations on land, on sea, on air, to the four corners of the earth and the seven seas are united and are victorious.
After the Second World War, Robert Trout continued to broadcast news on the radio, then later on television. We were fortunate to have Robert Trout on our air in his final years. He wrote essays for us, remembering his long career.
We are formed by the events that accompany our coming of age. For me, it was the Depression and World War II. For younger reporters, it may have been civil rights, the Middle East, or the Internet. People find their heroes in experience, not history, which is why the early years of this century may seem less important than they were. It may not be fair, but those early generations have taken their traumas and triumphs to the grave. It is the process. This is why life can move on, why tragedy and suffering do not accumulate in the human spirit, and why a next time may be just ahead when the last time has been forgotten.
Robert Trout, the veteran broadcaster, died last year, shortly after his 92nd birthday. This story was written and produced by John McDonough, with help from engineers Lorna White and Robert Newhouse.